Hello and welcome to Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. I'm James Holloway and I'm studying the myths and religions of the world and seeing what inspiration I can find in them for fantasy role-playing games. In today's episode, we are continuing our season on Tengrism, a religion common in medieval Central Asia and still around today. In previous episodes, we've looked at some of the deities of Tengrism. Today, I want to look at a related magical and spiritual practice and look at shamanism. Shamanism is a bit of a tricky subject. There's a question of whether this is really part of, you know, the religion or the mythology of Tengrism, and then there's a whole history of shamanism being studied in ways that maybe aren't very useful, and still people kind of thinking like this today. So let's cover those briefly first and, you know, do the usual disclaimers. So I think it's possible to argue that shamanism isn't Tengrism per se, or rather that it isn't Tengrism. Tengri play, or plays, depending on whether it's singular or plural, an important role in many shamanic traditions. I'm going to be focusing mainly on Mongolia here, but there are lots of other examples. And many people would tell you that, you know, there are people who practice or participate in these shamanic practices, but if you ask them what their religion was, they wouldn't tell you that they were Tengrists. They'd say they were Buddhists, or that they were not religious, or whatever. But that kind of like the dominant faith in the region is Buddhism. I think that's true in a sense, but more importantly, it raises an important question about what exactly we mean by a religion. And we've encountered this many times when we've run into religious traditions and religious practices that just don't fit the idea that there is such a thing as a bounded religion. We saw that when we looked at Vedic mythology. We can kind of see that when we look at Shinto. You can see it when you look at traditional Chinese religion, which obviously again crosses over with other spiritual traditions and doesn't seem to see that as a problem or like a threat to its definition. You know, I think that if you come from a European or post-European cultural milieu, it can be easy to see religion as a bounded entity that has specific beliefs and practices, right? You're either a Christian or you're a pagan. You're either a Catholic or you're a Protestant. This belief is orthodox, but that belief is heathen, that belief is heretical. And, you know, two things. First, that state of religion is very much the exception, not the rule globally. And second, that state doesn't necessarily tend to like actually exist the way that we kind of imagine it. That is something that religious organizations have portrayed their faith as. I would say it is more aspirational than actual. So the boundaries of religious belief and practice can sometimes be quite sort of permeable. And I would say that the most common situation is that beings and beliefs, especially cosmological beliefs, connect different traditions. You know, shamanism or shamanic practices occur in societies where the dominant faith is Buddhism, where the dominant faith is Islam, where it's Christianity, and I guess Tengrism. And it's obvious that many of the same concepts occur in Tengrism. It's just that Tengrism approaches those concepts in a different way, or perhaps it doesn't, because a lot of people will tell you that, you know, Mongolian shamanism and Tengrism are one and the same thing, and that the term Tengrism will sometimes be used to describe these shamanic practices. But when you look at sort of medieval letters that invoke Tengri, they're not talking about this kind of like magico-spiritual thing. They're talking about heaven in the traditional Chinese sense, or they're talking about, you know, God in the sort of Western monotheistic sense. They're talking about a relationship of faith and conduct with a supernatural power rather than like a series of ritual practices. Anyway, I guess what I mean is that if I'm saying that religions are not a bounded entity, the last thing I want to do is go down a rabbit hole about the definition of magic. But for our purposes, I think we have to just assume that all of these boundaries are a little bit fuzzy insofar as they exist at all. And for our purposes, that's a good thing. Now, one danger of taking that kind of universal approach is that it can then seem to you that shamanism is anywhere and everywhere, and that any magical or religious practice can be described in some way as shamanic. And that was a problem, I think, you know, particularly kind of in the post-war period, and also, although I know less about it, in the sort of ethnography of these cultures as practiced in the Soviet Union. I guess the idea being that Marxist academics had a tendency to be looking for universalities in these cultures, but also that's true of people who I don't think were necessarily Marxists in other parts of the world as well. So perhaps we can say that there's this long-standing trend of first looking for universalities in human culture, right? To identify like what is the primeval shared human culture, and secondly, to identify certain cultures in the modern day and think of them as being representatives of the past, which I think is misguided in a lot of ways. There are things you can learn from that approach, for example, about technology, but there are also things that you cannot conclude that people nonetheless have. And there were a lot of people who were looking for the fundamental human experience of religion, and they decided that, like, shamanism was a good example of that. And thus that label shamanism, which derives from ethnic groups in Russia, gets applied to religious or cultural practices that reject that label. So the term, for example, has been used to describe aspects of Native American spirituality or Native American religion a lot, and I know that that is not uniformly accepted, that a lot of people see this as an attempt to smooth out the differences between cultures and sort of rob them of their individuality. No one who studies the history of religion would say, Christianity, Islam, pretty much the same thing. But people will absolutely apply that label shamanism to spiritual or religious traditions that are vastly more different than those two forms of, you know, organized ethical monotheism. So this is something that historians of religion and magic argue about a lot, I guess is what I'm saying. But for our purposes, taxonomy is less important, right? This is a creative, not an analytical work. And a lot of games have a mechanical tool to distinguish this kind of thing where we have sort of different schools or methods of magic. So we're going to talk about this in gaming terms, and we're going to use, you know, Mongolian shamanism as a springboard. But if I find something interesting from another culture, I'm going to include it, and I just want to make clear that, again, we are looking for inspiration, not trying to model a real-world phenomenon, which is more complex than I can cover in this episode. Right, so having spent maybe way too long on the intro and disclaimer, let's jump into it. What is a shaman? There are a lot of contending definitions, but I'm going to say that for the purposes of this episode, a shaman is a magical or religious practitioner who mediates between the human world and the spirit world, often by entering an altered state of consciousness in which they enter the spirit world. Now, what the shaman does with that access to the spirit world can include a wide range of different purposes. So, for example, a common task of shamans is dealing with medical issues. So, if someone has a disease, the shaman may be called on to get rid of the evil spirits that are causing it. Or if someone feels like they're the target of evil magic, the shaman may be responsible for protecting them against that spell, blessing and cursing, telling the future. In many ways, it is not the things that a shaman is called on to do that distinguish a shaman from any other kind of magical expert, but the way in which the shaman does it, which is through the aid of various spirits and by this entry into the spirit world. Now, everybody was very into altered states of consciousness in the 60s, in more ways than one. Some people have been pushing back on that today, saying that the key aspect of shamanism is not the altered state of consciousness, but for our purposes, we're going to say that they are common. Now, socially, the role of a shaman can vary, but if you imagine that we are in the fantasy version of our Tengrist setting and heaven is off anointing the Khan as a man of destiny, the rest of the world, ordinary folks like you and me, we're worried about getting sick or about not being able to find enough pine martens to sell the skins and buy a new hatchet. Like, those are the kinds of things that we might go and see a shaman about. Hunting magic, also important in a lot of these cultures. The protection of livestock, right? So in many cases, these are sheep or horse herding cultures. So the magical or spiritual powers of the shaman are equally used in sort of like religious rites, but also in magical solutions to everyday problems. Now, as I said before, the type of shamanism used in some of these regions where Tengrism historically flourished includes a lot of elements that will be familiar to us. Indeed, they overlap so much that you'll find some sources that say, oh, Mongolian shamanism and Tengrism are the same thing and vice versa. But I think one main difference is the contextualization of the supreme Tengri, the eternal mighty blue heaven, as only one of many Tengri or deities or spirits. So Tengri is the head of, well, they're all called Tengri, but that Tengri, Cook Tengri, Monkey Tengri, whatever, is at the head of a huge pantheon of different spirits. There's also a form of interaction that is a little different from what we've seen so far in Tengrism. So what we've seen a lot of so far are the gods bestowing their blessings upon mortals, but not really mortals having that much to do with it. So for instance, if you remember the story of young Temujin, the future Genghis Khan, being trapped in the thicket, Tengri keeps putting obstacles in his way in order to keep him in the thicket where he'll be safe. But Genghis does not interact with Tengri, right? Like, Tengri makes these decisions and, like, sends omens and things, but it's just Genghis's job to respond to or interpret them, to make decisions based on them, but not to request or cause them. Whereas a shaman can ascend into the upper world, into heaven, to confer with the gods or spirits, to ask them for their wisdom, and so on. Now, I mentioned that large collection of Tengri, or spirits, they're vast. Again, traditions vary, but one of the most common sayings is that there are 99 of these beings, 55 of whom are good and 44 of whom are evil. In addition, there are a bunch of earth spirits, right? So I guess spirits of the middle world, of whom there are 77. They're all women. And then there are ancestral spirits. So the spirits of deceased nobles and shamans inhabit the landscape. And there are also hierarchies within those types of spirits. So there are greater and lesser spirits of shamans. And then there are other spirits who seem to me to be kind of like natural spirits. They're spirits that are lower than the heavenly spirits, and they too can be both good and evil. So it's a very richly populated world, and some of it is quite local. So for instance, those ancestral spirits are often tied to the particular clan of which they were members. So if you are a member of that clan, then you may be able to call on those ancestral spirits, or also to specific places. Spirits can also be associated with people, and an example of this would be the helper spirits of shamans. So, shamans often perform their feats with the assistance of particular spirits. In Mongolia, this is often, and in other traditions as well, this is often represented by the shaman's drum, which, for example, may be made of the skin of a horse or deer, and then that animal is said to be the steed of that shaman upon which the shaman rides into the spirit world. Or it may be that the shaman is able to transform into an animal form and thus travel about the spirit world. Symbolic representations of these animals are common. So for instance, a young shaman may have a staff that has a horse head at the top or a horse hoof at the bottom. And the idea is that this kind of embodies the horse spirit. Alternatively, you may see something like the drum stick that the shaman uses having like a horse head on it. So images of horses and images of animal helpers, those are common. Masks and dance are important parts of shamanic practice, and offerings to the spirits are an important part of shamanic practice. So this idea that, you know, everyone was concerned about altered states of consciousness, as I said, the idea that drumming and dancing are used to induce a trance-like state in which the shaman's soul, distinct from their spirit. So as an aside, one of the weird things about D&D is that it does have this very clear, at least in AD&D, distinction between a soul and a spirit. And humans have both souls and spirits, but elves and orcs don't have souls. They only have spirits. And then half-orcs don't have souls, but elves do. I don't know. I don't remember the exact details, but that distinction between soul and spirit was very interesting to me. So anyway, the shaman's soul can leave their body and enter the spirit world. And this may sometimes be visible to the onlookers as the shaman enters a kind of trance. Now, a lot of people have focused on the idea that entheogens, so certain, you know, plants or other substances that have kind of drug properties, are used to induce this shamanic altered state of consciousness. The most obvious example of this is in South America, where you get this kind of like ayahuasca tourism. This is a phenomenon in which people from wealthier countries, the first world, whatever, want to participate in the magical or spiritual customs of another community, but maybe without necessarily putting in the time needed to understand its history, its context, its significance. They're more interested in just getting high or going to a colorful local dance. And I suppose, you know, at some level you can argue that there's nothing wrong with that. It's, you know, lots of forms of cultural exchange are commercialized and aimed at tourists, and that doesn't mean that they don't have some value, but it does seem a shame that things that might once have been perceived as very important have become, out of necessity, targeted toward people who are less interested in what their home communities think of as their real spiritual significance. That's probably the fairest and most even-handed way I could have put that. I don't know that I'm qualified to speak on this, but this is kind of one of those places where the project of patron deities can kind of run up against the question of cultural appropriation. Cultural appropriation is a very loaded term, but when we get to like ayahuasca tourism, then I do feel like maybe we're entering into the idea of taking something that is supposed to be, you know, spiritual or sacred and commodifying it, even if what you're trying to sell to people is a spiritual experience. But on the other hand, selling people spiritual experiences is a human cultural practice that we've had as long as there's been selling. And I certainly don't want to be some kind of like authenticity cop. A lot of the time when we deal with shamanism, we are dealing with 19th and 20th century concepts and 21st century interpretations that actually don't go all that far back into the history of these cultures, but that I'm going to plunder because they're valuable for inspiration for other creative projects. So it is a little bit of a tricky field to navigate. I guess, I'm sorry, that's a digression, but I feel like it's particularly relevant when we deal with these kind of contemporary faiths. Just wait till we get to our season of Vodou. But anyway, my point was that people got very into the idea that drugs were the source of this altered state of consciousness. More recently, there's been more exploration of other ways in which altered states of consciousness can be induced. They could include things like music, motion like dance, or immobility. So for example, like standing in so-called stress postures for long periods of time. I edited an issue of ARC that had one about how prayer postures in ancient Greek might be in a sense stress postures. Meditation, sensory deprivation, right? All of these ideas that these could be ways to induce that religious state. In that altered state, a shaman can quote-unquote ride their steed or transform into an animal to undertake a spirit journey. Often, the soul ascends through the smoke hole of the shaman's home and then passes along a kind of spiritual journey, frequently beginning with a group of recognizable landmarks and then, you know, kind of getting stranger and stranger as they go toward wherever it is they're going. Often, there are 9 stages on this journey. You may notice that I'm being a bit non-specific. I got a lot of oftens and mainlys and sometimeses in here. And this is a bit tricky. Again, there's a bit of a balancing act. I'm trying not to base my account on like what one guy told an ethnographer one time. And there's a lot of writing on this subject that is a lot of different what one guy told an ethnographer. And the one guy frequently describes, well, I say guy, shamans can be male or female, though there are different words for them and they play slightly different roles. This one person, you know, tells an ethnographer, this is what a shaman does, when what they really mean is this is what I do. There's a great deal of variation, but I'm also not trying to like assume a generic shamanic culture that encompasses everywhere from Buryatia to Finland or whatever. Speaking of modernity and authenticity, I did read an interesting article about the work of anthropologist Manadu Hai Buin and Delger, who was writing about shamanism in contemporary Mongolia and saying that one of the reasons that shamanism thrives in Mongolia is essentially that Mongolia is kind of undergoing that search for national identity at present, because shamanism, so like Buddhism, was limited to some extent by the Soviets. You know, there were restrictions on Buddhist practice, but the Buddhist faith was not really wiped out, but shamanism kind of went underground. I'm aware that Mongolia was not part of the Soviet Union. It was, shall we say, strongly influenced. I mean, it was a communist state, but it was technically not part of the USSR. But because of that suppression under communist rule, a lot of shamanism is kind of being like reinvented or rediscovered or reimagined at present in a way that's like partly a search for a type of Mongolian national identity and partly just a search for solutions to the challenges of life in an economically deprived region. And that's true not only in Mongolia per se, but also in kind of minority ethnic republics within Russia, you know, Buryatia and whatever. And from these practices, like some things have begun to become sort of standardized. So like a common way of offering to the spirits is to like kind of whip up like a bowl of milk into the air. You know, that seems to be sort of a uniform thing. And like gradually through this process of trial and error, like certain conventions are emerging, but it's sort of happening in a way that we can observe. So I think that Mongolian shamans can be quite inspirational for gaming, as much because of their social role as because of their spiritual one. I think that the idea of having an independent spiritual practitioner in a shared but not formalized religious system is very gameable. In particular, shamans often respond to situations that are brought to them by community members. So they have this kind of like noir private eye feel to them. Indeed, if you are in modern day Ulaanbaatar, like a shaman might have like a storefront or an office that you could go to. That player character structure, I think, is really interesting, that you have this person who is a local community's kind of magical troubleshooter who is brought magical problems. You know, they are understood as an expert in this field. And that is something that I think is quite common in real world societies, but it's very seldom the way that a D&D character is motivated. You're sort of like local shrine priest or, you know, village wise woman tend to be NPCs, when in fact, that's quite an interesting role for a PC. I guess the question is, what are they doing in a party with like a fighter and a rogue? But even as an NPC, a shaman could be a really fun contact or ally for a party, particularly as a fun way to get PCs between planes. Now, I know that that's not what shamans do in shamanic cultures. The shaman goes to the other plane on your behalf. The shaman doesn't take you, for the most part, unless you're maybe being initiated as a shaman. The shaman doesn't take you to another plane. But I do think that having someone who's a specialist in that is an interesting way to bridge that mid-level gap. High-level D&D play has a little bit of a plane problem, which is if you want extra planar stuff to be an important part of your game, you have this problem where characters can move relatively freely between different planes in a way that sort of takes some of the mystery and excitement out of it. It's just not as weird or exotic or like boundary breaking as it ought to be. So I feel like, and then of course at low levels, you've got no business being messing around in the outer planes anyway. But so at that mid level, it's nice to have someone you can go to who can get you to another plane when there's a planar crisis and not have to like be planes people the rest of the time. And it's always nice to make the party snobs be humble and diplomatic towards some wise old elder. One thing that I didn't discuss very much in this episode is the idea of connection between religious traditions. So in Mongolia, they have this conception of what's called yellow shamanism and black shamanism. Yellow shamanism, sometimes called white shamanism in translations, used to be understood as like, oh, well, there's white shamans and black shamans. You know, it's white magic and black magic. It's good guys and bad guys. And I think today, that meaning still is around, but also you'll see people who use those terms. Yellow shamanism means shamanism that has a strong influence from Buddhism and incorporates Buddhist beings, Buddhist cosmology into its own cosmology. So they'll be like, oh yeah, this is what Tengri does, and then this is what Buddha does. And they're just understood as part of the same universe, which is not uncommon with Buddhism's interaction with other religious traditions. And then black shamanism, referring to a more traditional type of shamanism. I say traditional. Buddhism, of course, has been in these communities for a very long time. But it may even be neo-traditional, right? An attempt to connect to a religious tradition that is free of quote-unquote outside influences. I actually don't know how far that distinction goes back. I have seen it said with confidence that I have not seen the source of, that the distinction between these two types of shamanism, like that there's goodies and baddies, is one that was kind of created by anthropologists who that's what they expected to find, was that there was good magic and bad magic. Included here only to make the point that there are distinct shamanistic traditions even within the same culture. Now, we're just about out of time, and I feel like there's so much that I haven't said yet, but that's the nature of this type of survey. You know, we will probably see some stuff from Mongolian shamanism cropping up in later episodes. And I have to confess, it's a topic where I feel really out of my depth, right? Like, I'm not a historian of magic. I don't know very much about different magical traditions. And sometimes it's very hard for me to assess who I ought to be listening to on these subjects. That's me being honest about that there. Now, however, we're going to be on firmer ground in our next episode as we get into a little medieval history. And specifically, we're going to talk about a figure of the Middle Ages who's been very important both for the influence of Tengrism on that person and for that person's influence on Tengrism. So I hope that you will join me next time as we get a little bit Genghis Khan right here on Patron Deities, a show about deities for my patrons. Thank you for listening, and thank you very much for supporting Monster Man on Patreon.